accession number 18342, Reel 2.
Reel 2.
We were encouraged to smoke. Everybody smoked because everybody had cigarette coupons and chocolate sweet coupons. And every payday on a Friday, when you received your pay, you got your coupons with your pay. So it was a fair thing. Everybody got the same amount, and everybody smoked.
What happened to you next after the measles bout?
Well, I came back and joined the battalion again, and then we went on various manoeuvres still, and then we went on one particular trip. It was coming up towards the end of May, I suppose. It was coming up middle of May, and we went on manoeuvres, and unknown to us, we weren't coming back. Everything was packed. We always packed everything. Kit bag went into to the stores, and you carried your all your other things, your small pack and your large pack, and everything was you left nothing behind. And then we went on manoeuvres one particular week, and finished up in Crowhurst near Battle, under canvas. This was all prepared for us.
What happened to you under canvas at Crowhurst?
Well, we stayed there for I don't know how many weeks. Well, we were there until we went abroad, actually. But we still carried on our drills and training, and they had a large marquee. They had boxing and bingo. They called it housey-housey in those days, didn't they? And we went down to Hastings. Everybody was supposed to learn to swim, and I'm afraid I never did, but... The idea was for when we went abroad, I suppose, so that you could sort of it'd help you in if you got any problems at sea. And as I say, we did still carried on our training. The idea, they said, was that to baffle the Germans, they wouldn't know where people were moving, because we moved suddenly. Different people moved to different places, and we stayed down there until such times that we were expected to be going abroad. And we packed up one day, and we moved into a transit camp. And I never knew where the transit camp was. We went to a certain area, and everything was shut in. Before we left Crowhurst, near Battle, everything was censored. There were no letters allowed. You couldn't write at home. You couldn't... telephone home, but you never did telephone home in those days. But all correspondence stopped, as if we didn't exist. And the idea was to stop any knowledge getting out as to what was happening or where we were. But just before we left, we went down to one afternoon. We were called out on parade, all dressed, smartly dressed, turned out, inspected, marched down to Battle, and we were told that the VIPs were coming through from London to come down and inspect the troops in that particular area. And we were stood in the streets of Battle, and a large car came through, staff car, with Winston Churchill, General Smuts, and various other dignitaries in the cars. They were going down through to inspect the troops in that particular area, and our job was to just wave them through, sort of speak. And it was quite interesting, actually. General Smuts was South African Prime Minister at that particular time.
And then we
went to the transit camp. And we're in there, entertainment, all sorts of things. Nothing was too much trouble. They had all the famous film stars and local dignitaries and people used to come and entertain us. And we weren't allowed outside of the camp. And then one day we were put into vehicles, and we went down to New Haven to board a ship for Normandy. After the D-Day landings. We didn't leave England until about I think it was about the 12th or around about the middle of June. And the weather was very bad at that particular time, as I remember. I remember the planes going over by the droves of airplanes going over to bomb or whatever. And we finally set sail for Normandy in the middle of the night and landed in Normandy on the beaches the following day. We scrambled down the sides of the ships and got onto the landing craft and almost landed, just dropped into the off the front into the water about waist deep, and up the beaches. There was no firing or anything because the forward troops had pushed the Germans quite a way inland. They'd got a good a fair bridgehead, and we established an area and settled ourselves in open country and dug in and waiting for instructions.
Which beach did you land on?
We landed on Gold Beach, if I remember rightly. I can see there was a house on the right hand side going up the beach, and quite a high one, and all the original barbed wire from the German defences there, and the signs Achtung Minen on these placards, which they cleared the mines anyway, so we went through there, and I can remember it quite well, going up onto the top road, and we marched on until we came to like a open country and cornfields, and we were told to settle ourselves in this particular area. All the battalion was scattered all around us there, all around the area, and we stayed there for further instructions, because we had lost all our transport was bombed when it got to Normandy before they landed. Most of it was on board ship, and it sank, and they'd lost a lot of equipment and a lot of the guns and all the other equipment they had, and they had to wait for reinforcements of that particular type of equipment. Most of it was machinery, and I think most of the men were on a different ship, and most of that went down at just off Normandy, actually.
And what happened to you next?
Well, we got orders then after a day or so that we had to put an attack in at a place called Chu. I don't know how you spell it. I think it's Chatux, and we had to take over from a Scottish regiment, and it was just like the Devonshire Lanes. We got into a orchard and dug in against the hedge of this orchard, and there were snipers all around us. They said you don't have to watch for snipers, and all of a sudden this battle started, and we thought it was our tanks coming down the lane. You could just see the tops of the turrets over the hedge, which is a narrow lane, and lots of skirmishing going on, and our officer was a Canadian, he was a Canadian, and they had them on what they called can loan, or loan can, or something, which they were loaned to the British Army, the Canadians, and they were wonderful people. This one was a lieutenant in our section, and he was giving us a running commentary over the hedge of what was happening, and they knocked out several tanks there, and our commanding officer was by this time called Lieutenant Colonel Atherton. He went up to help up the lane to help the anti-tank gunners. It was a battalion anti-tank gunners, because several of them had been knocked out, that had been killed, and unloading the guns. He was helping to load the gun, this particular gun, in the lane as the tanks came down, and they hit the tank and hit the anti-tank gun, and he was killed instantly with the rest of the crew. But we did manage to push the Germans back, and we managed to consolidate the other side of the village, and we thought we did very well. That was our first action, and we didn't know what was going on, actually. It was all very confusing, but there was quite a lot of things flying around, and we did very well, so they told us. So we had to. We did lose quite a few people there, obviously, and that was the end of that particular action, as far as I remember. We stayed around there for the time, dug in, and then we went on from there. We went on to Hill 112, which was quite a famous hill at the particular time. It was high ground, and it had to be captured so the British Army could push on through and capture Caen. Whoever had this particular ground could see for miles around, and the Somersets and the Dorsets were all in our division, which was the 43rd Wessex Division, and the Somersets put in an attack at first on the hill at night, and they failed, and then we had a go at the next day. I remember that was our first action on 112. It was very frightening, actually, because it was open ground and it was a slight slope upwards and it was cornfields, and we had to attack up through the cornfield until we got to the top of the hill, where there's a hedge and the woods on the downward slope. And we formed up in a ditch, and the artillery was firing over our heads to soften up the opposition, and I thought it was very, very frightening. And our commanding officer, Major Vaudrey, he was a B Company commander, and he said, "Just keep firing your rifles as you go." And we found it after a while. We found it not quite so frightening, and the tanks came up through with us, which were drawing a lot of the fire, and we got up into an orchard, and it was just our section. I remember our section. Everything else seemed to disintegrate, and we stayed there until it was quite dark, and we had instructions to withdraw back to Battalion HQ, and we drew back. We didn't know it was Battalion HQ at the time, but we drew back to this particular area under a hedge and alongside another hedge, and there were trenches, slit trenches there, and we were in line going down through, and two tanks came across our front, and somebody in the cornfield was putting up flares, and as we stopped to let one tank pass through, the other one stopped behind us, and we walked through, and as we got past them, they opened fire. It happened to be two Tiger tanks, so we dived in the trenches, and one man behind got hit in the back. And as we looked across, we could see this man putting up flares. The idea was to illuminate everywhere so that he could see, or his tanks could see what to fire at. And it happened to be a German. So one of the lads in our trench, he shot the German. He fired and shot the German. And it was, after a while, it quietened down then, and we had to sort ourselves out. And the next day, we put in another attack. And that sort of semi-failed, I remember, and we went back to the start line again, if you like, and it was chaos, actually, and after a while, we were reformed again and went through, and we got to the woods, got to a wood this particular time. We got into the edge of the woods, and the artillery was coming over, and our artillery was coming over and hitting the tops of the trees, and it was exploding in the trees like twigs, but they're very, very sensitive, apparently, with the artillery. We got instructions then from somebody, and we were only a few men there. They were scattered rather far and wide, a lot of wounded on the edge of the woods, I remember. And we were told then to withdraw. We didn't have any smoke, they said, so you have to just make a dash for it. So we made a dash back the way we came, and picked up a friend of mine. He was on anti-tanks, and we jumped onto a carrier, and the carrier didn't stop until he got back for about quite a few miles, and they sorted us all out the next morning, and we went back again, and we put in another attack, and I think we captured the area that we needed at that particular time. But it was very chaotic, and we lost a lot of men there. And the Duke of Cornwall's headquarters, they put up a sign up on the hill marking it Cornwall Hill. There's now a plaque, there's now an obelisk up there, which is the 43rd Division monument up on Hill 112. And we've been up there a couple of times in past years, anniversaries, and held a service up there. And the people are very, very kind, especially around all these battle areas. We found them very, 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 very kind when we've been back. Very nice people. And nothing has been too much trouble. Always welcome when we go. And from there on, we moved on. We did a few more attacks. I can never remember the names. We did a few more attacks, and we were successful. And after a time, they pushed the Germans right back into Belgium, and all the transport had to be used for bringing up ammunition and stores, so we had to stay put, and we were out on a sort of a kind of rest until such times as they were going to put in an attack to take Arnhem for the bridge too far over Arnhem Bridge, and we were going to be leading troops on this particular drive right up through Belgium, Holland, and right in through Nijmegen, right up through until we got hopefully to Arnhem and relieved the 1st Airborne Division at Arnhem.
Could I just stop you there and go back to Normandy before we go on to Arnhem? Which particular company, platoon and section were you in?
I can't remember the section, but I was in B Company. I can't remember the section, but... I joined B Company from the beginning, actually. And as I say, Major Vaudrey was killed on Hill 112, and it was a Sergeant Tejan, I remember. And there's so many names, I can't remember any of them now, actually.
You don't know which platoon you were in?
I think 10 platoon. I think it was 10 platoon.
And what was the leadership like in the company?
Well, we formed up, say, on 112, and the officers were there with us all the time. They were very inspiring, I thought. They were there, and you had confidence that you were going to win through this. And I think, really, for infantry officers, they were very good, actually, because the snipers... Remember, the snipers were around all the time, and the idea of the snipers was mostly to knock out the leadership. If they could knock out the leadership, kill them or whatever, they would find that they'd have an easier time, hopefully, because people would just panic or whatever, and all sorts of things would happen.
How successful were the enemy snipers in knocking out the leadership?
They did very well, I think. They were very... very, very determined people. They used to strap themselves up in trees at Hill 112. After Lieutenant Colonel Atherton got killed, we had a Lieutenant Colonel James, and he was about mid-20s, very young man. And up on Hill 112 on the first drive, he was up in Battalion HQ under this particular hedge, and there were some trees in front of them there, and all the trees were all badly damaged. There was no leaves on them, and just branches. And he got up in this particular tree to observe the Germans, find out where the Tiger tanks were. And his batman said to him, "Sir, I'd get down if I were you." And as he said that, so he came tumbling down dead. The sniper had got him up in the tree, and. That was two battalion commanders in a matter of 2 weeks we lost. And from then on in, we had a Lieutenant Colonel Taylor took on the battalion from then on in. And he took us right through till the end of the war, actually.
In Normandy, did you see close up any of the people who were killed?
Yes, all around. It's very, very... I think really you've just got to put it out of your mind, actually, because people were just lying there. You couldn't do anything for them. They were dead. If we had a chance, we used to roll them in a blanket and put them in a slit trench and just bury them, and put a rifle, bayonet down, and a helmet on top to denote that it was either a German or a British soldier buried there. And they were rolled, well, they were all over the place, on the sides of the road, covered in dust and dirt and filth. Some of them got driven over by tanks, unfortunately, dead or alive, if they were wounded, especially on Hill 112, because of the fact that they were in the cornfield. Although the corn was being battered down, people that just dropped, they couldn't be seen by the tanks, and the tanks went through, and some of them, unfortunately, got driven over. Very distressing, really. But these things happen all the time, and in the height of battles, there's nothing anybody can do. You can't stop and help a man. The stretcher bearers are there for that job, and they have to. The infantry had to just carry on as best they can.
Did you bury German corpses as well?
Well, we didn't. On occasions we might do, but not very often. They were just at the side of the road or wherever, and mostly we left the Germans for the people coming up behind us. They were soon cleared, actually. It was soon surprising how they soon cleared these people off the roads, which was very distressing to see some of them. But you just had to get on with what was happening. That was life or death, whichever.
How good a shot were you?
Well, I was pretty good at target practice, but you know, we never fired directly at the Germans. I think mostly it was just firing for courage, to give you a bit of courage and sort of help you along in a way, because the artillery was doing most of the damage. The artillery was firing over our heads. They would be firing so many yards in front, what they call a creeping barrage. And as we went forward, the barrage would go forward, and most of the Germans would keep their heads down, and you wouldn't see a lot of Germans until after the barrage had finished. And then when they had counterattacked, and they always counterattacked, the first thing you did when you got in your positions and consolidated to dig a slit trench and get down so that you were reasonably covered from artillery fire and mortar fire. They had these terrible mortars that they called them moaning minis. They fired six mortars at a time, and they made an awful noise when they started off, a terrible noise, and it really gave you the creeps. You knew very well there was going to be six bombs drop in your area somewhere, and they were very, very accurate on their fire with the German. And the Spandos were machine guns which fired terrific rate of fire. And you could differentiate between the British and Spando, the British Bren and the German Spando. And it was very, very frightening to hear the Spandos fire, and they could really cut you in half.
You mean when you said that you were opening fire for morale purposes?
Yes.
Did you ever fire at an individual target?
Only on odd times, if you see a German moving, if you were in positions and you saw movement, you just fired at movement. It would be quite a way away in most cases, and you wouldn't know whether you would hit anybody or not, but you just fired in the direction of the movement, hoping that you'd either hit something or frighten them to get moving or whatever, get their heads down.
So you wouldn't see an enemy soldier usually?
You wouldn't see an enemy soldier right up. No, they'd be. The thing is, with so much British artillery, so much firing, that they wouldn't be able to put their heads above their slit trenches, because of the fact that they'd be mowed down with artillery. They'd be blasted out of their positions if they tried to move. They had to wait until the artillery passed them, and then they'd be up and at you, sort of thing. But most times they'd run, and only the fanatics would stay and fight, fight to the death, actually. And that was machine guns, mostly, and the snipers were there. And really, you didn't mow them down as such. You didn't. You just might hit an odd one for all you knew. You might hit an odd one. It's the same with them, I suppose. They didn't know whether they'd hit us or whether they'd just fired into space. But it was more for morale most of the time. As we went up through open ground into an attack, you fired at random just in front of you, and that helped to keep the Germans' heads down as well as the artillery. And it worked that way, I think. It did help a lot.
What did you think of the German enemy in Normandy?
Well, they were very brave people. There's no doubt about that. They were fanatics. They really were. There's not a finer fighter, I reckon, than the Germans, and everybody respected them.
Did you feel any hatred towards the enemy?
Not really, because they were doing a job that they had to do. They had to be in the army and they had to do that job. We were more hatred against Hitler and all the top people. I always thought that the SS were the worst people. Well, they were fanatics and they were rather hateful. They could be very unpredictable. They'd just as soon shoot you down if you were in the open, or if you were. I know of cases where they'd shot prisoners. There were several cases of shooting prisoners after they'd captured them, and that's the sort of thing that they would do, and that's the sort of people that were hated. But most ordinary Germans, I think they were fairly decent people.
What did you know about the shooting of prisoners?
Well, we'd had in our battalion, we'd had a case or two of Germans shooting prisoners as they were coming up to give themselves up. They'd run out of ammunition or whatever, and they were in their slit trenches. And as they came up out of their slit trenches, they were shot where they stood. And I knew of a couple of sections where this had happened. And in fact, the sergeant in charge was lived to tell the tale.
Do you think that this really happened?
Yes, I do, actually, yes. It was isolated. It wasn't a regular thing. It wasn't a regular thing, but it did happen from time to time. I suppose they got frustrated over various things or whatever, and they perhaps had some knowledge of something happened similar to them. I don't know.
Did you personally take any prisoners?
We did capture an odd one or two, but they come in dribs and drabs, and the idea was to push them back behind us, and they would sort of go back until somebody would take them over, but because we'd never had a chance to really get them all sorted out, and you had to carry on, and somebody behind you would sort out the prisoners. Hopefully, but if you left one man in charge, we found that if you left one man in charge and said march, they would march, and for them.